So if you had, say, $130 in your pocket right now, you could actually buy a fractional piece of a luxury property right in the heart of Riyadh.
Which is pretty wild to think about.
Right. I mean, really think about that for a second. Like 10 years ago, trying to do that as a foreign investor wouldn't just be bogged down in impossible red tape. It would be, well, practically illegal.
Oh, absolutely.
But today, it basically takes a few taps on a smartphone. So how exactly did Saudi Arabia go from being this, closed-off traditional oil empire to a digital, fractionalized real estate hub? Welcome to today's deep dive.
Yeah, glad to be here.
We are exploring a massive stack of research and comprehensive guides on investing in Saudi Arabia under their Vision 2030 initiative. Our mission today is to figure out how a nation is engineering one of the most aggressive economic pivots in modern history. And more importantly, how you, the everyday retail investor, actually fit into this completely overhauled financial landscape.
Yeah, and it is arguably one of the most ambitious macroeconomic experiments happening in the world right now. I mean, to truly grasp it, we have to look at the underlying motivation, right?
Right, the why behind all of this.
Exactly. For almost a century, Saudi Arabia's immense wealth was, entirely dependent on a single finite, highly volatile commodity sitting beneath the sand, oil.
Which is a risky long-term bet.
Very. So Vision 2030 is their aggressively funded blueprint to basically future-proof the nation against a post-oil world. And what's fascinating here is their underlying strategic advantage.
The location, right.
Yes, the geography.
Yeah.
They aren't just trying to build like a self-sustaining local market. Sitting precisely at the crossroads of Europe, Asia, and Africa, they're actively positioning themselves as the inevitable logistics and financial conduit between the East and the West.
Okay, let's unpack this because the grand vision is one thing, right? But as an investor, you want to see the actual execution, the
You
numbers.
need to see the proof.
Exactly. And the source material highlights some macroeconomic realities from 2024 that genuinely caught my attention. We're looking at a 1.3% overall economic growth, which, on paper sounds somewhat
It
modest.
does sound a bit slow, yeah.
Right. But the critical detail here is that this growth was driven entirely by the expansion of their non-oil sectors. The government data shows a massive 30% revenue increase in recent years, coming directly from real estate, tourism, and tech.
Yeah.
So the non-oil engine's actually pulling the train now.
Exactly. And that 30% metric is honestly the most vital signal in the entire data set. We really need to appreciate the mechanics of what is happening here. Diversifying a massive, established national economy is incredibly difficult.
Oh, I bet.
I mean, it's not like simply changing a corporate strategy. It is highly comparable to a legacy tech giant like IBM back in the day, trying to pivot from massive mainframe hardware to cloud computing.
That is a great comparison.
Right. You have to completely rewire the infrastructure, retrain the workforce, and change a deeply entrenched cultural mindset. And you have to do all of that while the original engine is still running and funding the transition.
So the oil money is paying for the pivot away from oil.
Precisely. The fact that capital is successfully flowing into these non-oil avenues and, generating real measurable returns proves this isn't just a theoretical white paper, it's actually happening.
I hear that. And a 30% revenue spike definitely looks great on a macroeconomic chart. But let's be real for a second. I'm going to play devil's advocate and push back here.
Sure, go ahead.
Historically, when a foreign emerging market undergoes a massive top-down government transition, it is notorious for bleeding retail investors dry with just bureaucratic friction.
Oh, the red tape is usually a nightmare.
Right. If I'm an everyday investor sitting in London or New York, aren't the walls just too high? I mean, unless I have an army of international lawyers on retainer to navigate the local ministries, how am I not just going to get crushed by legal fees before I even make my first trade?
That is a completely valid skepticism. And frankly, it's the exact friction point the Saudi government realized they had to eliminate if they wanted to survive.
Because money goes where it's easy, right?
Capital will always follow the path of least resistance. Historically, yes, foreign investment meant navigating this crazy labyrinth of different ministries. You had the Ministry of Labor, the Ministry of Commerce, local municipalities. You were basically in legal limbo for months.
Which would scare off anyone but the billionaires.
Exactly. But we are seeing a structural demolition of that bureaucracy right now. The old Saudi Arabian General Investment Authority, SAGIA, was completely overhauled into MISA, which is the Ministry of Investment of Saudi Arabia.
Okay, but changing an acronym doesn't automatically remove the lawyers, does it? So what does MISA actually do differently?
Well, it fundamentally changes the operational mandate. MISA functions much more like a high-end concierge service for capital rather than a traditional, governmental gatekeeper.
Oh, interesting. A concierge service.
Yeah. They have digitized and consolidated the licensing process into a single, centralized portal. They offer pre-clearance for foreign capital, dedicated relationship managers, and accelerated legal structuring.
Wow, so they really smoothed it out.
They did. Mm-hmm. They aren't just permitting foreign investment. They are aggressively streamlining the plumbing of the financial system so global investors can onboard capital without needing that army of local lawyers you mentioned.
Okay, so they've effectively built a fast pass lane for setting up private enterprises. That handles the private equity side, I guess. But what about public markets?
That's opening up too.
Yeah, because the sources note that the Tadawul, which is the Saudi Stock Exchange, has been radically opening its doors. They've introduced these qualified foreign investor or QFI program.
Yes, the QFI framework is huge.
Meaning international investors can now easily access massive Saudi blue chip giants like Saudi Aramco and SABIC directly from their standard international brokerage accounts. Like, you don't need a special middleman anymore.
You don't. And the offerings on the exchange are maturing rapidly. I mean, the Tadawul isn't just listing legacy petrochemical companies anymore.
Right. And this is the part that genuinely gave me pause when I was reading the research. The sources show a growing presence of exchange-traded funds, ETFs, specifically focused on ESG funding. Environmental, social, and governance.
Yeah, that catches a lot of people off guard.
I literally had to read that twice. An ESG-focused fund in a state historically defined by petroleum extraction? I mean, that feels like a massive oxymoron.
It definitely sounds contradictory at first glance. But if we connect this to the bigger picture, it is a brilliant psychological and financial play by the government.
How so?
The introduction of ESG metrics and strict transparency guidelines by the Tadawul Group is a direct signal to global institutional capital. When foreign pension funds or massive asset managers look at a new market, their primary hurdle is a lack of institutional trust.
They need to know the books are clean.
Exactly. They need compliance, they need audited transparency, and they need global standard reporting. By enforcing these exact ESG and reporting frameworks, the Tadawul is actively engineering an environment where Western capital feels secure.
So they're basically speaking the language of modern global finance.
Precisely. It's all about building that institutional trust so the big money feels safe flowing in.
Okay, so we have the public markets sorted out. But buying a ticker symbol on an exchange is, well, it's the traditional, somewhat expected route.
Sure.
The source material actually dives into something much more tangible, and historically something much harder for foreigners to touch, which is physical Saudi land.
Oh, yeah. Real estate is notoriously the most heavily fortified asset class in any sovereign nation.
Always.
To understand the shift here, we really have to look at the baseline. Traditionally, foreign nationals required explicit individual government approval to buy any property in the kingdom. And there are strict hard lines. For instance, owning property in the holy cities of Mecca and Medina remains strictly prohibited for non-Saudis.
Which, I mean, makes total sense given the religious significance.
Absolutely. Now, direct freehold ownership, similar to those special designated property zones you see in places like Dubai, that is widely expected to be formalized in the near future.
Okay, but what about right now?
Right now, the most accessible entry point today is investment-based ownership in hypergrowth hubs like Riyadh or Jeddah.
And here's where it gets really interesting. Because if you want to invest in a commercial high-rise in Riyadh, you don't need $100 million. And you don't even need a traditional real estate broker.
No, you don't.
The guide introduces tokenized fractional ownership via blockchain. Now, normally, when people hear blockchain, they immediately think of, highly speculative cryptocurrencies.
Right, dog coins and all that.
Exactly. But here, the technology is being used purely as a ledger for physical hard assets. Think of it like a pizza. Imagine the property is a giant pizza. Instead of having to buy the whole pie, the property is legally sliced up into digital tokens through smart contracts.
That's a perfect analogy.
Right. So you don't deal with title companies and mountains of escrow paperwork. If you hold the token in your digital wallet, you hold the cryptographic proof of your legal fractional ownership of that slice of the building.
And it fundamentally solves the biggest problem with traditional real estate, which is liquidity.
Because you can't just sell a house overnight.
Exactly. Real estate is inherently illiquid. It takes months to buy or sell. But by tokenizing the asset, platforms like Osul Gamma, which are heavily featured in the research, they've reduced the transaction friction to near zero.
It's just wild.
It is. You can buy or sell a fraction of a commercial property almost as easily as you trade a stock. And this completely democratizes the asset class. Like you mentioned at the top of the show, the barrier to entry has just vanished. We're looking at entry points around $130.
And it's not just random, you know, small apartment buildings either. The tokens being offered are frequently tied to the supply chains and infrastructure of their massive mega projects.
A big one.
Yeah. We're talking about NEOM, that futuristic city build.
Yeah.
The Red Sea Global Tourism Project. And Diriyah Gate. These are the absolute crown jewels of Vision 2030. And smart contracts are allowing a retail investor to legally own a micro fraction of that development for literally the cost of a nice dinner.
It represents a total paradigm shift.
It really does, because if you are using decentralized smart contracts to instantly settle microtransactions for multi-billion dollar real estate developments, you are no longer just an oil economy.
No, not at all.
You are operating a high-level tech economy. Mm-hmm. And that realization logically shifts our focus to the capital city. We really need to look at what is happening on the ground in Riyadh.
The metamorphosis of Riyadh is just staggering.
It's explosive. We historically picture Riyadh for its cultural heritage sites or, you know, its massive energy conglomerates. But right now it is behaving much more like Silicon Valley.
It really is.
It's becoming this high-velocity startup hub. The guide points to homegrown, massively scaling successes. You have Tamara, which is absolutely dominating the fintech space, and Jahez, which is a juggernaut in the food delivery and logistics sector. These are unicorns.
They are. But we must emphasize to the listener that this startup boom is not some organic grassroots accident.
Oh, it's very intentional.
Extremely. The Saudi government is heavily engineering this ecosystem from the top down. They realize that to sustain a tech economy, you need founders to take massive risks. So the government is actively stepping in to absorb that risk through initiatives like Monshot and the MISC Foundation.
How exactly are they absorbing that risk, though? Are they just, like, writing blank checks to anyone with an app idea?
No, it's much more structured than that. They're utilizing things like regulatory sandboxes.
Okay, what does that mean in practice?
So, for example, when a fintech company like Tamra wants to launch a new financial product like Buy Now, Pay Later, legacy banking laws usually make that impossible for a tiny startup.
Right, the compliance costs alone would kill them.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A regulatory sandbox allows these companies to legally operate, test their products on real consumers, and iterate without violating those legacy banking regulations.
That's huge.
It is. And furthermore, these government accelerators are providing matching grants, waiving massive initial licensing fees, and offering deep institutional mentorship. They are systematically lowering the cost of failure, which naturally encourages rapid innovation.
That is incredibly smart policy. And for you, the listener, it creates a really unique investment environment because, again, you don't need venture capital money to participate in this startup ecosystem.
Not anymore.
The guide outlines several low capital plays. You can back these startups directly through licensed equity crowdfunding platforms. Or if you prefer a more traditional vehicle, there are REITs, real estate investment trusts that are publicly listed on the Tadawul.
Which is a great indirect play.
Right, because they provide regular dividend-style income based on the commercial tech spaces that these exact startups are renting. There are even local government-approved micro-investing apps that let you funnel spare change straight into the Saudi tech sector.
The sheer accessibility is unprecedented. But, as with any emerging market undergoing hypergrowth, unparalleled accessibility inevitably brings significant exposure to risk.
Yes. So, what does this all mean for the cautious investor? Because let's be completely honest here. Whenever you combine the words tokenization, fintech, and foreign emerging markets in a single sentence, every financial red flag you have should naturally go up.
Oh, 100%.
It is incredibly easy to get swept away by the narrative of 30% revenue spikes and frictionless smart contracts. But it's a time for a reality check. Where are the landmines?
A measured, highly skeptical approach is absolutely essential here. The text explicitly outlines several major danger zones. First and foremost, for any foreign investor, there is the persistent, unavoidable risk of currency exposure.
Because you are converting your local currency into Saudi rial.
Precisely. Now, currently, the Saudi rial is pegged to the U.S. dollar, which actually provides a significant layer of stability compared to other emerging markets.
That's good to know.
It is. However, if macroeconomic pressures ever force a decoupling, Or, if the monetary policies of the U.S. Federal Reserve and the Saudi Central Bank diverge significantly, that exchange rate could drastically impact your actual localized returns. You are taking on sovereign currency risk.
Okay, so that's the macro risk. But what about the tech side? Because blockchain platforms sound great until the regulatory winds suddenly change.
That is the second major landmine. While blockchain is currently enabling these new real estate platforms, global and domestic regulatory frameworks surrounding crypto assets are still highly fluid.
They're changing all the time.
Exactly. There's an ever-present risk of using platforms that might suddenly fall out of compliance. And frankly, the sheer excitement surrounding Vision 2030 has attracted straight-up scammers who prey on the FOMO, the fear of missing out of global retail investors. The landscape is extremely dynamic, which makes it inherently treacherous to navigate blindly.
So, how do we build a defense strategy? How do you protect yourself while still taking advantage of this massive geopolitical pivot?
It comes down to vetting.
Right. The guide is adamant that you must establish your personal risk tolerance and precise financial goals before moving a single dollar. But crucially, when you are vetting these tokenization platforms or crowdfunding apps, you must strictly rely on official verified channels.
You cannot just trust a flashy website.
Exactly. The text explicitly names MISA, the Tadawul Exchange's official public filings, and financial portals like Argum as your non-negotiable sources for market data. If a platform isn't certified by these entities, you walk away.
Due diligence is your first line of defense, but your ultimate defense is the oldest, most reliable rule of investing.
Diversification.
Yes. Mitigate your risk through aggressive diversification. The true beauty of the Vision 2030 initiative, from an investment standpoint, is the sheer breadth of its ambition. You don't have to go all in on a single, highly speculative fintech startup.
You can spread it around.
You can strategically spread your capital. You can hold a baseline of Tadawul blue chip ESG funds, allocate a portion to tokenized commercial real estate in Riyadh, and then put a smaller, riskier fraction into a logistics crowdfunding campaign.
Makes sense.
By distributing your capital across entirely different sectors and asset classes, you ensure that if one specific regulatory framework tightens or, you know, one sector underperforms, your entire portfolio doesn't just get wiped out.
It's about engineering balanced exposure. And to prove that this specific, low-friction, highly diversified approach actually works in the real world, the source material provides a really compelling case study.
Oh, the Miriam case study. I love this one.
It's great, right? It brings all these abstract concepts, smart contracts, regulatory sandboxes, compounding yields firmly down to earth.
Yes. Miriam's strategy is basically the perfect practical application of everything we've discussed today.
Right. So Miriam is profiled in the text as this tech-savvy 30-something. She wanted exposure to the Saudi growth narrative, but she absolutely did not want to lock up massive amounts of capital. And she had zero interest in dealing with the headaches of international property management.
Who does?
Fair point. So she utilized the exact mechanisms we just outlined. She deployed just $1,000 into a tokenized, fractional, Riyadh-based residential apartment using a regulated blockchain platform. $1,000. That was her entire initial exposure.
And it is the mechanical execution of what happened next that truly matters here.
Right, because it wasn't just sitting there.
Exactly. Over the course of a year, she didn't just passively wait for the underlying asset, the Riyadh apartment, to appreciate in market value. Because her fractional ownership was codified in a smart contract, the rental income generated by the tenants of that apartment was automatically and proportionally distributed to her digital wallet as a steady dividend.
That is so cool.
There were no management companies taking a 20% cut. No international wire transfer fees eating into her margins. The smart contract just executed the yield automatically.
Meaningful, frictionless yields from a tiny initial investment. And the brilliant part is she didn't just cash out and buy a TV.
No, she kept it moving.
She took the dividend returns from the Riyadh apartment and reinvested them into a completely different sector. She used the yields to buy tokens in a commercial hotel development on the Red Sea coast.
That diversification we talked about.
Exactly. She is literally building a highly diversified, compound-yielding Saudi real estate portfolio from her laptop. And her out-of-pocket cost was only ever that initial $1,000.
This raises an important question, doesn't it? What does it actually mean for global finance when everyday people, rather than sovereign wealth funds, massive private equity firms, or billionaires, are actively and directly funding a nation's foundational economic growth?
It's a complete flip of the traditional model.
It is. Miriam's story proves the central thesis of our source material today. Participating in the Saudi market in 2024 is no longer restricted to those with massive institutional capital. It is entirely about leveraging new financial technology to make smart, deeply researched choices that allow for gradual compound growth.
It really reframes the whole concept of emerging market investment. So, to synthesize everything we've covered in this deep dive, there is no single best or correct way to invest in Saudi Arabia right now. And honestly, that is exactly the point.
The variety is the feature, not a bug.
Yes. The overarching takeaway from this entire stack of research is the staggering diversity of options that have suddenly become available to you. You can go the traditional, highly regulated route and purchase blue chip stocks on the Tadawul exchange. You can back a disruptive food delivery app operating in a Riyadh regulatory sandbox. Or you can buy a $130 tokenized fraction of a luxury high-rise. The fundamental advice from the sources is clear. The walls have come down. Your money can now work for you in this market. And thanks to the tech infrastructure, it can do so fairly passively.
I'd like to leave you, the listener, with a final, broader thought to mull over.
Go for it.
We've spent this time breaking down the internal mechanics of Vision 2030. But consider the profound cognitive dissonance of this transition on a global scale. We are watching a nation historically funded by the world's most finite, heavy, physical resource oil, attempting to transfer its foundational wealth into the most intangible, digital, and fractional assets imaginable.
It's a crazy contrast when you say it out loud.
Right. If Saudi Arabia successfully pulls off this monumental pivot, what happens to the global economic balance of power? Will other resource-rich nations, whose economies are currently entirely dependent on what they can dig out of the ground, be forced to completely copy the Vision 2030 playbook just to survive the next century?
That is a deeply fascinating question to leave on. Watching the ultimate physical commodity transform into a decentralized digital economy is going to be the financial story of the decade. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the rapidly shifting landscape of Saudi investment. Keep exploring, always question your assumptions about how the global market operates, and as always, stay curious.